I'm Todd Jones, recovering from 30 years as a sports writer. Thanks for joining me as I sit down with some of the best sports writers of our time, who knew the greatest athletes and coaches, and experienced firsthand some of the biggest sports moments of the past half century. We'll share stories behind the stories, some we've only told each other. Pull up a seat on PressBox Access. Randy Harvey grew up in a tiny town in Texas, but sports writing took him around the world. And he took readers with him to World Cups, Super Bowls, golf majors. He took them along with the Showtime Lakers of Magic and Kareem. Most of all, Randy took fans to summer and winter games as one of the most prominent Olympic writers of the past four decades. I'm eager to travel with him on this episode. Well, Randy, it's so nice to have you on the show. I really appreciate you joining us. How you been?
Thank you. Good. Doing well.
It's been too long since I've chatted with you. I know whenever we were at big events together, you were always a voice of wisdom for me. You always had some nice advice. There were times when I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But if I went to Randy Harvey, he always had the answer.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot. I hope I didn't take you too many blind alleys.
No, well, if we went down blind alleys, we went together. So, you know. And sometimes there were good stories down those blind alleys. So, Randy, 50 years of surviving the newspaper industry, I think you ought to have some kind of reward for that.
Well, it was a very rewarding career. And when I look back on it, some amazing experiences. And that's my reward is to have been able to do as much as I did and cover as many big events and see as many places as I did. And went all around the world on the newspaper's dime. So,
not bad. How many countries, Randy?
Oh, I've never bothered to count them up, but you name it, I've probably been there.
Yeah, your passport must have had about 40 pages. You're a writer and an editor, which meant that, you had to deal with the writers, and I always feel like you had to be like the head of the class then, knowing all these screwballs out there and sitting in the desk. You had to keep control of these guys because you knew who they were.
Well, being a writer and then becoming an editor, I had a great perspective. There was nothing the writers could come up with that probably I wasn't able to answer, or probably hadn't had a similar experience.
When I think about your career as a writer, especially, I think about big beats, big events, big cities. I mean, you worked in Baltimore, Dallas, Chicago, New York, Houston, and also obviously nearly 30 years in Los Angeles at the LA Times. So you've been, the big places, the big markets, and you covered so many, big stars and events that we got a lot to talk about.
I grew up in a small town of 3,800 people.
Really?
My dream was to go to the city, and so I went to just about all of them. So.
3,800. Was there a newspaper in that town?
Yeah, the Mineola Monitor.
Did you ever write for it?
Yeah, I did. And when I was in high school, I wrote for the high school newspaper, and so they used to, the downtown newspaper is the one that published that, so they would use my stories sometimes.
What did you mean by downtown? The stoplight?
That's right. We had two stoplights.
Well, you come from a long line of great Texas sports writers. I mean, there's so many famous sports writers from Texas, Dan Jenkins, Blackie Sherrod, on and on. And I found a quote from the early 70s when you were young in your career, and Blackie Sherrod said, he was asked about the future of sports writing, and he said, "I got a kid named Randy Harvey with all the earmarks, if he'll stick with it." Were you going to not stick with it? Did you have thoughts of doing something
else?
No,
I don't know. I think he thought I'd get smart and get out, but I stayed in it, and I did stick with it.
Well, Randy, when you were growing up in small town Texas, and there were so many great writers down there, did you have favorites? Did you have people who influenced you? Was that part of why you became a sports writer?
Probably the biggest influence on why I became a sports writer was Claire B. He was a former coach who wrote all the Chip Hilton novels, and I would devour those when I was in grade school, and then I would try to write a book, and I just really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the process. As soon as I got a chance to go into journalism, I did. So that was probably the biggest influence on my career. And my dad was had worked in newspapers too. So,
oh, was he a writer or an editor? Or?
He was actually a school teacher and then a school administrator. But in the that didn't pay very much. So in the summers, he'd work at the local newspaper, the Lufkin News.
So you grew up with ink on your fingers.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the smell of newspapers, and it was just part of your life from an early age, I assume.
Exactly.
From the outside, they think that writers, oh, you're just friends with all these guys and you're cheerleaders. And but that's that you have to learn early on, right? That that's not the case, that you're a reporter and you're the conduit to the fans. Is that something that was stressed to you early on in your career in Texas?
Yes, we had an orange stick. It was a paint can stick, a stirrer, and it was orange and white. And if you wrote something too complimentary at the Daily Texan, you got the dreaded orange stick.
Really?
And that was not good. We get the orange stick. My years there, only got it once. And so for a story I wrote on the freshman basketball team.
So it was too complimentary.
Yeah, so it was too, if you were too complimentary, you got that orange stick. Sometimes I think it probably took us overboard into negativity, so we had to learn balance, after right. that too. So now to try to be straight down the middle and not always negative.
Right. But I think that's a great lesson, the orange stick.
Yeah, but I did learn. I wasn't part of the team.
You couldn't be, right? Right. I mentioned Daryl Royal, the football coach at Texas. And I also think there was a moment early in your career when he had some redheaded, bearded, ponytailed guy, some country singer he wanted to introduce you to. Tell us about this moment.
He called Kirk Bowles, who's an American statesman, been there forever, and I were out covering practice, and he called us over one day. He says, "Hey, I want you to meet somebody. This is Willie Nelson." And I didn't know who Willie Nelson
really?
Was at that time. Yeah, and so I really wasn't into country music. So anyway, shook his hand, was glad to meet him, and then it was shortly after when that outlaw country took off, and I certainly knew who Willie was after that. So,
well, Willie's a big star, obviously, and you were around so many big stars in your sports writing career, athletes, obviously, and I think that's only appropriate that you spent nearly three decades of your career in Los Angeles, in Hollywood.
Yes.
So you were in Chicago, you were in New York, but you left New York in 1981 to go out to the LA Times, and you became the beat writer to cover the Los Angeles Lakers.
Right. It was the Magic and Kareem and
Showtime.
Jamal Wilkes. One of the first big stories I had was Paul Westhead getting fired. That was my first year on the beat. It was about 3 weeks into the season.
Oh, so, welcome to the beat.
It was thrown into the fire. Then Pat Riley took over, and Pat was great. Pat was great to do
that. So tell me about that. That was a story that was huge news at the time when Westhead was fired, because they had won the NBA championship the year before under Westhead, right?
No, they'd lost it. I think, my memory serves, I think they had lost to Philadelphia mm-hmm. that year. And then they came back, and then they won it under Riley the first year I covered them.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, Magic, the substitution rotation that Westhead used, Magic complained about it. Next thing you know, Westhead was gone. Magic, to his defense, a lot of people thought he got the coach fired. He never asked for Westhead to be fired. He just was making remarks about, how he didn't like the substitution rotation. But the Lakers acted and brought in Riley, and it worked out.
Randy, how many seasons did you cover the Lakers for the Times?
Just two full-time.
Two full-time seasons. So, and this is really when Showtime's taken off with Pat Riley. What was it like in the Fabulous Forum all those nights?
Oh, it was unbelievable. They had the USC pep band. Jerry Buss was a big USC fan, so they had a pep band and Dancing Barry, who was a sort of a mascot guy.
Wait a minute, Dancing Barry?
And then Chick Hearn. Of course, you had Chick Hearn.
Yeah, the announcer, yep.
All in the games, and the crowd was Jack Nicholson sitting on the sidelines, and you never knew who you were going to see, Deborah Winger or Angie Dickinson or just Doris Day, anybody.
That's amazing. You mentioned that Pat Riley was great to deal with. What made him great to deal with from a writer's perspective?
Honesty. If you asked a question, he answered it. He wouldn't lie about it, about things, I always really appreciated that. He didn't, if he made a mistake, he would admit it. And if you asked him about it, he didn't seem to mind being asked. He wasn't defensive about it. I don't know. He was just, I thought, probably the best I ever covered in terms of that.
Do you think that came from him being a player all those years too?
Could have been being a player. Could have been. It's just the way he was. He was that way at Kentucky. He told a great story about the Texas Western game because he was in that game.
1966 Rupps Runts.
Yeah, one of the most famous college basketball games.
Right. The all-black lineup for Texas Western beats the all-white lineup from Kentucky.
Right. That's what he talked about. He grew up in Schenectady, New York. His dad was a minor league baseball coach, but used to take Pat to the playgrounds and just let him loose. And so Pat grew up playing with the black kids, and he learned a lot. But he got to Kentucky, and when they played that Texas Western game, he said he knew they lost even before the game, because he says his teammates were just scared to death. And, of course, he wasn't, because he'd grown up playing with black kids, and he tried to tell them, hey, they're just kids like anybody else. They're like us. You know, don't. But he said his teammates were just literally shaking. And so he said, I knew then we weren't going to win.
What do you think made Riley the right coach at the right time with those Lakers?
His wife was a psychologist. I think he learned a lot from her. You know, I think he would have, you know, if he had issues, he'd just go home and talk to Chris about it and do their pillow talk, talking about that. So I think he learned a lot about psychology.
Did you ever talk to her about basketball?
I talked to her. I don't remember talking to her much about basketball. I remember going to the Forum Club after games. She was there, and so sometimes we'd talk to her. But
tell us what the Forum Club was.
Forum Club was, you know, obviously in the Forum, and it was just a little bar where after games the writers and celebrities would go, and, you know, Bus would make an appearance, and sometimes the players didn't go there very often, but Pat would always be there, and his wife would be there. Chick Hearn would be there, and it was just a place where you gathered. Jerry West. It was just a place where you gathered, and you just talked, and you got to know each other.
I think that probably helped, right? Because you could relate to people. They knew what job you were doing. You know what job they're obviously doing.
Right.
But you were able to build some type of relationship, right? Working relationship.
Right.
We talked about the Lakers and the scene and, you know, Showtime and their stars everywhere. Well, you couldn't have had two bigger players than Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
No. It was unreal. I remember Bill Dwyer, the sports editor, he said, since maybe you don't know it yet, but you're going to look back on this and it's like you covered the 1927 Yankees. And
he was right.
He was right.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
He was right.
Unbelievable collection of basketball talent and characters.
It's interesting how sometimes in life the right group of people come together at the right time. I mean, obviously there was talent there, but was there something else there that made those Lakers special?
Magic, I think, was his enthusiasm was just infectious. And I think that probably had a lot to do with it. I mean, he lit up a room. He exuded confidence. Everybody on the team kind of fed off of that. Pat used to talk about this. There was a feeling around that team. He said, like Kareem would go up for his sky hook. He said, and there was just a sense that everybody in the building was feeling that. And there was some sort of magical essence to it of it rubbing off on the players too. So
you mentioned Magic's enthusiasm. What was the difference between Irvin Johnson and Magic Johnson?
Irv was real. I mean, and nobody called him Magic. I never heard anybody ever call him Magic.
They called him Buck, right? Didn't the players and coaches call him Buck?
Yeah, Buck or EJ or Irv or Irvin. And yeah, he was a real person. He had that magical enthusiasm, and somebody gave him that name. But yeah, Buck was a very good name for him. It talks to just like he was just a real guy.
Well, he was so out there with his personality, and then you also had Kareem, who was much more reticent with how he dealt with everybody. Tell us about dealing with Kareem. He was, you know, when I think about Kareem, I think sometimes I wonder. You know, he almost gets overlooked sometimes when people talk about the greatest ever and it's Jordan and so forth. But look at Kareem's career. It's unbelievable. Do you think his personality has something to do with the fact that maybe he's not always just knee-jerked reaction to, like, Kareem's the greatest ever?
Yeah, probably so. Probably so. I mean, he wasn't out there. He was just, you know, Magic was such the big presence on that team. And I think Kareem enjoyed that, enjoyed having other players take away the attention from him. But obviously he was one of the greats of all time. And I think he's usually, I see him right. I mean, he was all-time leading scorer. I was there that night when he passed Wilt to become the all-time leading scorer. And so great experience. And Kareem was, if you could get him alone. He didn't like that locker room experience that, you know, sports writers coming in and crowding around the cubicle, and mm-hmm. he didn't enjoy that. But if you got him alone, he used to tell stories about growing up and, you know, in Harlem, and his true love was baseball. He'd been a first baseman on his high school baseball team.
Kareem was a first baseman?
Yeah.
Wow. He could catch all the throws.
Yeah, exactly. Not anything went over him, that's for sure. So, but if you got him just telling stories about those days in high school and growing up, he was actually, you know, quite pleasant mm-hmm. under those circumstances. But he didn't like that crowd of sports writers. The Riley used to call us the buzzards. Said, you know, Kareem thinks you're buzzards.
Well, I think we were buzzards, right?
Yeah, probably
When you think about it, like, can you imagine every day you get done with your job and somebody comes in with a bunch of questions for you?
Oh, yeah. No, I wouldn't enjoy it either. Especially, you know, standing there, you know, with, you know, half clothed.
Or, right.
You know, just in your underwear.
Right. So. Right. Nobody ever goes into the Rolling Stones in dressing room after the game, after the concert, and say, "Hey, Keith, what happened on that chord there? I think you missed the chord during Gimme Shelter."
Yeah, or, you know, yeah.
Well, you had a couple years with the Lakers and Showtime, and that's, you know, such a part of our culture and sports. It's a moment in time. But really, the bulk of your career as a writer, especially, you know, was international sports.
Well, when in the 84 Olympics were coming, and so I'd covered the Lakers in the early 80s, Bill Dwyer, the sports editor, put me on the Olympic beat in 83 to get ready for the Olympics. And he sent me everywhere to all the major championships because he said I wasn't the only one, but the writers, if you have a beat like swimming beat, you go to the big swimming meets or track. I was doing track, so I went to all the big track meets. Whatever your beat was in the Olympics, he sent people there because he said when the Olympics come and those athletes come to L.A., I want them to know who you are so that they'll answer your question. If you see them in the mixed zone or whatever, that you know they're going to answer your question first because they know you.
And you had covered the 76 games, right?
Yeah, I covered 76. I was at the Chicago Sun-Times, and they sent me up to Montreal, and that was fun. And, you know, covered Nadia Comaneci. I'll never forget Dick Young going through the press room and telling American writers, "Don't cover the gymnastics. It's just a dance contest." And I thought, how can you say that? How can you not cover Nadia Comaneci?
Were you in the arena the night she had her perfect 10?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I covered all of her performances there. She was 16 and, you know, showed no jitters and just very stoic and poised about it. So, and of course, and then there's Bella Caroli over on the sidelines so cheering her on. He was not poised, but he brought the enthusiasm to it.
Hit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on.
So you covered the 76 games, and then they're coming to Los Angeles, which is a whole different beast, right? Because all of a sudden, you're writing for the newspaper in the city where the Olympics are being hosted. That seems to me to be very overwhelming as a writer and a reporter. What was it like to be on the team that had to cover for the host city?
Oh, I liked it. I enjoyed the challenge, and you know, and that's what I accepted. As I knew that everybody would be reading, you know, what I was writing because that was the local paper, and I just took it as a challenge and said, you know, okay, you can, let's do this. So. You know, I loved it and got to know so many writers through that. You know, they recognized my byline and, you know, seek me out in the press room. So I got to know, you know, just about everybody in the business.
Right. Let's talk about those 84 games in L.A. because when you think about it, in 80, the Americans had boycotted the Soviet games. And now the games are coming to America. The Soviets return the favor, and they boycott, and their bloc nations boycott. But the 84 games, when you think about it, In some ways, they might have saved the Olympic movement in the modern era. Do you think that's true, and why?
Well, Peter Ueberroth was a genius at marketing. His unique plan to go out and sell different sports to different sponsors. So you wouldn't just, you could buy the entire Olympic package, but also you could just buy a sport. So you buy track and field, or you could buy gymnastics or volleyball, you know, just whatever you wanted to buy. So that opened it up to so many other sponsors, because before then they had been restricted to you have to buy the whole package. So it brought so many other sponsors into the games with so much more money, and kind of taught the Olympic movement how to deal with
Well, we talked about how the Lakers, you know, a group of people together at a certain time, it's magical. That summer of 84, it was just right for America. You know, Ronald Reagan's the president. It's the summer of Bruce and Prince and Madonna, and everybody's into it. I think the Americans won 170-something medals.
Yeah, something summer. Like that. Yeah, they were, you know, obviously without the Eastern Bloc there, except for Romania, without the Eastern Bloc there, it was kind of easy pickings for the U.S., but it was good. You know, it created an atmosphere, and you know, people obviously in the United States loved it. So.
What was the atmosphere like in Los Angeles for those weeks?
I think there was a lot of pride, you know, a lot of joy that the games were going off and were so successful, and there was no traffic, so people loved that.
So wait a minute, how was there no traffic in L.A.? Tell me about this.
Well, people were so frightened of the Olympics. A lot of people left town, or a lot of people took vacations, so they wouldn't have to deal with the traffic. And so as a result, there wasn't much traffic. And people really used the buses to get around. So they had a lot of extra buses and a lot of extra routes for people. So that was, it all contributed to it. And the weather was perfect. So it was just a magical time.
Well, the big star of the games, obviously, was Carl Lewis. Won four gold medals to match Jesse Owens.
I'd say Carl and Mary Lou, yeah.
Mary Lou, yeah. Well, let's talk Carl first. What was, you know, he seemed to have this whole other presence about him that went beyond track and field. What was it like covering Carl Lewis during those 84 games especially?
Well, he was another one that wasn't very easy to deal with personally. He didn't like much media attention and didn't like prying into his life for whatever reasons. And so he wasn't that easy to deal with. But obviously, you know, one of the best athletes we've ever seen. So you can help to write about laudatory things about him. You have to remember there was the drug issue.
Right.
The steroids, you know, had kind of captured a lot of attention from track and field. And Carl always resented that. And particularly some in the European media would accuse him of, you know, he's so good, he must be on drugs. Mm-hmm. Without ever really any evidence whatsoever. So Carl, he resented that too. So.
What stands out about him as an athlete when you, not dealing with him, but just chronicling what he was doing on the track?
Well, just how smooth how easy it seemed to come for him. He didn't seem to be working at it. He just seemed natural.
That seems to be the case with the great ones, right? They make the hard thing look easy. And yes, no matter what it is, if it's athletics or whatever, it's something like, but what that comes from is all the preparation, right?
I think so. And, you know, Carl had been preparing for that moment since he was, you know, a junior high school student. And yeah, and so he obviously a lot of preparation. And he had a great coach. Tom Telez out of the University of Houston was, you know, one of the great track and field coaches. And Carl was fortunate to be able to work with him.
Now, you mentioned Mary Lou, and that's Mary Lou Retton, obviously.
Yes.
She captured the hearts of America in 1984. Did you cover the gymnastics competition?
I was mainly covering track and field, but I was there that night, and I did a sidebar on Mary Lou. And I did it mainly on Bella, because Bella had left Romania and, you know, was now coaching Mary Lou. So my sidebar was on Bella, and he used to call her Little Buddy, but everybody, it was the accent, everybody thought he was calling her Little Body. So I saw a lot of stories there saying, Little Body, but either way it worked.
Yeah. So that was at Pauley Pavilion, right? The competition?
Yes.
Tell us about that night and what was special about seeing Mary Lou Retton win the gold medal in the all-around with a perfect 10.
Well, Eastern Bloc dominated, so the Russians weren't there, but the Romanians were there. And everybody kind of thought the Romanians would be the would be the class of the Olympics because of the Eastern Bloc, and they've been so successful. You know, Mary Lou came out with that perfect vault and stole the show.
What was it about her that captured everybody?
Her enthusiasm, her smile. She had that huge smile, such joy. She just said, took such joy in it.
Well, you must have taken a lot of joy covering those games when they were finished in Los Angeles, because I'm sure you were putting in some good hours during those weeks.
Yeah, it was kind of a letdown after they were over. But the LA Times sent me to Europe after that because the there's a those series of great track meets in Europe every year and the Grand Prix meets, because they wanted to see how the U.S. athletes would have stacked up against the Soviet bloc, the Eastern bloc athletes. So I went all over Europe covering in Scandinavia, covering that, and it was just fascinating. Obviously, the Eastern Europeans won their fair share, but the U.S. had a great track team.
Do you have a favorite athlete that stands out? Some of the names that you got to see are incredible. You know, Michael Phelps, obviously, or, you know, Michael Johnson, Dan Jansen, Usain Bolt. I mean, it goes on and on. Tell me about some of the favorites that you got to witness at the Olympic level.
An athlete I particularly appreciated was Edwin Moses.
Yeah, kind of forgotten. Yeah.
I think his winning streak was 88 at one point. And he just seemed to he was perfection. And that's such a difficult race, the 400 intermediate hurdles. And the way he handled that pressure of a winning streak, I think he's as close to perfection as I've seen in an athlete.
Why do you think he was able to handle it?
Great focus. You know, and that hurdles, you have to have your steps exactly right. You just can't be off a stride, and he just never was. And I think he just, he had really great focus, obviously very intelligent and very focused.
Well, there's so many great things that happen in Olympics, but sometimes there are some really, terrible things. And in 88 in Seoul, the big story that happened was on your beat in track and field was with Ben Johnson.
Right. Yeah, and there had been speculation for a long time that the Canadian athletes, Ben in particular, were using drugs, and, that's where it all came about.
What was it like covering that particular story?
Oh, Bill Dwyer had gotten to know some of the sports editor of the LA Times, had gotten to know some of the Korean officials very well. And I remember he called at 4 a.m., said, if you were sleeping, you're not anymore. He said, I just got a call that Ben tested positive. Get up here and get down to the office. So it was at the office and by 4:30 or so. And then I think around 11 is when they had the press conference to announce it. But because of the time difference, we were able to get it in the paper. So we actually had it first.
Well, that's got to be a... one that you always remember is in terms of being right there when a historic moment happens. It's not a great achievement by somebody. Unfortunately, it's a bad thing, but sometimes that's what happens in the
Olympics. Well, it altered track and field forever, and I still enjoyed covering it, but it wasn't the same after that. I mean, there was so much suspicion. Any time anybody had a great performance, there was suspicions.
How did you balance that out as a reporter, but also somebody who appreciated it from somebody who likes the sport? How did you balance that out in your own mind?
Well, I had to separate it. I mean, I had to be, a reporter first. And so
right.
Just sitting there enjoying, I enjoyed watching, but I didn't let that, move over into the professional side. Tried to be as vigilant as everyone else. And after that Ben Johnson incident, they had inquiry and Canada, and I actually spent the whole summer in Toronto, had an apartment there.
Did you really?
Spent the whole time there just covering that Dubin inquiry, and would just go back to LA on weekends. Fascinating, Charlie Francis and all those Canadian athletes, and how much we learned from it about drugs and the use of drugs.
How long did that go on?
Oh, it was I want to say about 4 months.
4 months on the same story. Wow.
Yeah. Well, the Canadians took it very seriously, so which, good for them.
But that can be overwhelming, though, right, all of a sudden.
Right.
That's like the only thing you're thinking about and dealing with. It's almost, I can remember moments like that in your career where you're like, oh, what happened? You don't even know what's going on in real life because you're just totally wrapped up in the story.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
The other Olympics that you covered, are there certain moments that stood out? You know, we talked about some good and we talked about some bad, but when you think about somebody says, hey, Randy, you covered all those Olympics, what comes to mind overall for you?
Tanya and Nancy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I saw the movie, I, Tanya, and I didn't think they got it right. I thought they were much too sympathetic to Tanya. I mean, there was just something pathological about her. And, you know, I'm sure she didn't have the best of all upbringings, but there was just something that was wrong about her. And if you didn't have to spend much time around her to know about it, when we were at the trials and Nancy was kneecapped, somebody came in and told us about it in the press room, said, you know, Nancy's been injured. Somebody attacked her. It's funny, Christine Brennan, who I think you had on this show before, and others, we just turned to each other and said, Tanya. Everybody just said it at the same. Everybody said it at the same time. You just knew.
What is it like covering the World Cup? And because when you think about it, you were covering it, you know, as soccer was kind of building in America. But when you go to the World Cup in those days, what was it like?
It was wonderful. You know, the first real international soccer experience I had was in Trinidad and Tobago when Paul Caligiuri hit the goal from far out to win the game for the U.S. and send them to the World Cup, 1990 World Cup in Italy. And it was the first time in, you know, since the 50s that the U.S. had qualified for a World Cup. So, but the Trinidadians, they couldn't have been better hosts. And even after they lost, they were just wonderful, you know, joyous people, and so much fun to be there. And then to go to Italy and be assigned to cover the U.S. team, and their home base was in Florence, which...
Not a bad home base.
Unbelievable city. And then to go to Rome for the finals, and New York Times and the L.A. Times shared an apartment, and it's a place where Dostoevsky had lived. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so such fun. We had a party. I announced we were having a party at that apartment, and about 50 of the volunteers showed up with one bottle of wine. And so they were standing at the door with this one bottle of wine. I said, "Oh shoot, I think we're gonna have to make a wine run." So, but great experiences, and probably the best World Cup moment was the women's, when Brandi Chastain's goal and the famous shot of her tearing off her jersey, and just that you know, that moment stands out among other for so many reasons. First, the thrill of victory, as they say, and then the women's empowerment.
Yeah, why did that? When you think about that, we're talking about moments in time that come together. What was it about that women's soccer team, the U.S. women's soccer team? Why were they the right team at the right moment?
The people on the team, there was Brandy, but there was, of course, Mia Hamm, and then probably the team leader and the one they all looked to was Julie Foudy. She had so many instructions on the field. They called her Loudy Foudy. But she was great to deal with. And the team was just, you're right, it was just the right team. Michelle Akers and just so many players who stand out. And then that, whoever the photographer was who captured that picture of Brandy on her knees and clenching her fists, and, you know, the big smile on her face, it was just unbelievable.
What was it like in the Rose Bowl that day?
It was one of the first women's sports, I thought, where people took it as seriously, treated it the same as the men's sports. You know, all of a sudden, you know, there was no difference. There was no men. There were no women. It was just sport. And I think it set the stage for what has continued to happen throughout the years.
At the Athens Olympics, I was talking to Mia Hamm, and I said to her, I said, I have two daughters. They're little, and they play soccer. And I said, you and your teammates had a lot to do with that. You know, because 20 years before that, if I had daughters that age, they weren't probably going to play soccer, you know, and I think, and she actually, you know, seemed very appreciative of that comment. I'm sure she's heard it before, but it was kind of nice to express that to her, because as a father and a journalist, I got to see both perspectives there, and they did. They had a cultural impact on women's athletics.
Yeah, I think they were the trailblazers.
Well, Randy, your career as a writer took you all over the world. When you think back and you think about 50 years, do you miss it? Do you miss being a writer? And is there something you miss about it?
Yeah, I miss the the camaraderie, you know, the staff and, you know, and just, you know, being among the crowd of sports writers, you know, going to those events and being with a lot of people. Yeah, I missed that.
There's something about that feeling of being in that group. They're all kind of like the misfit toys.
Yeah, I like sports
writers.
They have
this warped perspective on the world.
Right.
I think it's too much travel, too many deadlines, but they're also kind of funny. Think about this. You survived 50 years of the newspaper industry, so they should give you some type of award for that. I mean, you even survived an assassination attempt, right? Diego Maradona shot an air rifle at you. Is that right? The Argentinian soccer star?
Yeah, we had a great interpreter, Jeri Longman from the New York Times, and I had a great interpreter, and she said, you know, I'll try to, so we said, hey, what can you do for us? Can you get to Diego? She says, well, I'll try. And so she got him enough to come out to the balcony, but he wasn't welcoming, though.
What happened?
Oh, nothing. I think he just shot it into the air, but anyway, I don't think he was trying to hurt us. I think but it was a good experience. It was fun.
You sound like somebody from Texas. Ah, he just had a gun. He's fired it in the air. No big deal.
Yeah, you see it all the time here.
Well, Randy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, it's been great to reminisce and just great to catch up with you.
Likewise.
There was a moment in my own career, I will leave you with this. It's a thank you to you. There was a moment, you probably don't recall, but you and I had a conversation where I was thinking about going into news projects and taking a leave from sports. And I didn't know what to think about it. And I remember talking to you at length about this, and you really encouraged me and said that it'll show that you're trying to challenge yourself and grow. And I did that, and I left sports for a few years, and it made me a better reporter.
Oh, it made me
experience things that that I had never come across. And then when I did return to sports, I just had a whole different perspective. And I don't know if I ever properly thanked you for that, but you had a big part in that.
Well, thanks for pointing that out. You're welcome. And I never met anybody who didn't benefit from spending a few years as a news side reporter. It made them better sports writers.
Thanks for listening to Pressbox Access. You can find us here with a new episode every other Wednesday. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe and follow us on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app. We'd love for you to review us. 5 stars would be nice. Follow us on social media. Drop us an email at pressboxaccess@gmail.com. And be sure to spread the word. Everyone is welcomed here. This has been a production of Evergreen Podcast. A special thank you to executive producers Michael D'Aloia and Gerardo Orlando. Producer Sarah Wilgrube. I'm your host, Todd Jones. It's closing time. Rock on.
Ready to up your game and learn more about the thrilling world of sports betting? Introducing Double Down with Breslow, the ultimate podcast about the business of sports gambling. Join me, James Breslow, and a long list of expert guests as we dive into the art and science of the sports betting industry, evolving regulations, technology enhancements, and the meteoric rise in the number of players makes this sector the fastest growing and most intriguing in the world. Unlock the business secrets from many of the industry's most recognizable C-suite executives, including famous odds makers and influencers. Every episode of Double Down with Breslow is packed with insider tips, deeply skilled analysis, and in-depth discussions. Don't miss out on the ultimate resource for mastering the business of sports betting. Listen to Double Down with Breslow on the Evergreen Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's Double Down with Breslow, the business of sports betting podcast.